programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Culligan Water of Cache Valley, family-owned and operated for more than 62 years, providing Culligan bottled water, salt delivery, or soft and conditioned water. Hey Culligan Man, service from the man in blue, online at logan.culliganman.com.
Welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and we've got a great program for you today. We're going to start out, though, with Nancy Williams and the latest Petals and Prose segment. Nancy is a journalist and a beekeeper and a good friend of mine and actually just loves literature, and you're going to learn how to stalk raspberries.
I did not understand the nature of obsession until I became a stalker of raspberries. I did not even understand why it was appropriate for Ewell Gibbons to name his classic treatise, Stalking the Wild Asparagus. In my innocence, I had thought that stalking was reserved for animal prey. I came late to raspberry picking, and now I practice it with the passionate intensity of those whose conversion happens deep in middle age. Don't worry, I won't try to convert you. I wouldn't think of letting anyone else into my raspberry jungle. Lori Colwyn, the author of that description of the raspberry jungle, continues that piece in More Home Cooking, A Writer Returns to the Kitchen, a marvelous book published in 1993, about a year after she died. She says, 10 years ago, when we first rented an old house in northwest Connecticut, my husband started a vegetable garden on which we both bent all our energies. It wasn't until 2 or 3 years later that I looked up and realized that all that time, the undifferentiated tall grasses behind the vegetable garden, between the crabapple tree and the stone wall, had actually been a thick tangle of goldenrod, wild grape, nettles, bindweed, honeysuckle, and wild raspberries. My first visit to the raspberry jungle was a revelation. It wasn't quite as welcoming as Andrew Marvel's garden. The nectarine and curious peach into my arms themselves did not reach, but it was not the hostile place I had expected. I found that if I dressed modestly and moved respectfully, the shy creatures of the raspberry jungle would admit me. Rima the raspberry girl, you might say. Here's the solipsism of raspberry stalking. While you're doing it, nothing exists except for you and the next raspberry. I've felt some of that same urgency when I've picked cultivated berries at Ellsworth Hill Farm nearby, but I fear that's the urgency of greed. Picking cultivated berries is like shooting fish in a barrel. Maybe it's also like cornering the silver market or leveraging buyouts. I wouldn't know. I do know that by the time I've got 10 pounds of cultivated berries in my basket, I feel slightly sick. Not only because I've eaten a pound or two en route, but because it's all been so effortless. The rows are tidy. The raspberries are enormous, brazen, meretricious. The hussies drop into my basket with vulgar willingness. That's no sport to it. But when you pick raspberries in our jungle, you don't find berries of easy virtue lounging on every spray. You don't know where the next raspberry is coming from. You just enter a trance of searching, a state at once immediate and remote. You unconsciously assume a watchful crouch so that you can move easily from cruising to reaching. You have to decide whether to carry your basket with you, go to the heart of greenness and risk spilling the contents if you bend, or whether to make short forays and carry back the berries to the waiting basket, trying not to crush the damp handful in the cup of your fingers. I use my left hand for delicate tasks, separating the few drupelets of an imperfect berry from the central cone, and my right hand for bold maneuvers, the lunge toward a red gleam that's slightly out of reach. I avert my eyes from the yellow-green nakedness of unripe berries. Not a pretty sight, but a reminder, as if I needed it, that ripeness is all. Perhaps it sounds as if there are lots of decisions for the stalkers to make. There aren't. Berry stalking is so atavistic that it requires only a certain low vegetable cunning, a love of what goes from hand to mouth. it's all visual. Raspberries do not bolt, scurry, or quiver with explanation. God created raspberries in large part so that we would preserve them in glowing jars to stack smugly in the cupboard. Lord knows I love jam making, the ravishing color of the berries as they first combine with the sugar, the moment when the thickness is just right, the satisfaction of ladling the wanton jam into the tidy jar. When you've picked in the raspberry jungle, there's also the pleasure of getting something for nothing, though I've never found more than a pound and a half of wild berries at a time, even on a good day. In jam terms, one large jar and one small is what that makes. But raspberry picking is not invariably about jam making, any more than sex is invariably about procreation. When I make jam, I am at my most housewifely, firmly indentured to the domestic future. But the sublime concentration of raspberry picking is an out-of-body experience. It clears the mind of domestic cant. It brings freedom, transcendence. Sometimes a raspberry is only a raspberry, and you can't let raspberry picking slide over into allegory. Our raspberry jungle is a literal jungle, not the jungle of life or Pilgrim's Progress or America on the threshold of the 21st century. I suppose, though, there are homely lessons to be learned from it. Great pints from small drupelets grow. Cover up or you'll get scratches, bug bites, and maybe Lyme disease. Greed will be punished by spilling. What is unripe today will be ready tomorrow. But I don't see raspberry picking as the crucible of human character. I just feel that I must get out there every day and pick. As Dr. Johnson did not say but should have, to be tired of raspberries is to be tired of life. Or Goethe, ditto, the eternal raspberry leads us on. This has been a reading from Laurie Colwin's book, More Home Cooking, A Writer Returns to the Kitchen. My personal favorite recipe for raspberries is so simple. I think it's the same as Laurie Colwin's. It's the one where you take yourself out into the raspberry patch with a big bowl and you start picking. And you do this in the morning, just before noon, so the sun isn't beating too fiercely on your head. And you avoid all the scritches and the scratches. And you do this and you sit out there in the raspberry patch for about half an hour. And then you look at your bowl and you see that there are 5 berries on the bottom of it and that there's raspberry juice dripping off your chin. And you say to yourself, this is good. And you go inside for the day. I'm Nancy Williams for The Zesty Garden. Bon appetit.
Thank you to Nancy. My mouth is watering because and my raspberries are just starting to come on for my summer bears. So I'll be able to enjoy that recipe. I'm joined by Diane Alston, USU Extension entomologist, and we'd like to have your questions or comments in our program. Call us at 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or go to send us an email, zestygarden@gmail.com. Thanks for coming in.
It's always fun, Brian.
Plenty of insects to talk about.
This time of year, no shortage of bugs, for sure.
Plenty of them there. And what I wanted to talk about right away, though, was I guess you'd call them gastronomical insects. Have you ever eaten an insect?
I have eaten some fried crickets and grasshoppers. They were, we did it, it was back when Dr. J. Karen was still with us before he retired. And we did it as a state fair activity. And it was really a lot of fun. And a lot of people did try them. A lot of people didn't want to try them. But my experience was they just basically tasted like the oil they were fried in. They didn't have a lot of flavor. By the time you deep fry them, they're pretty crispy and they just kind of fall apart and in your mouth and they taste like the oil. There wasn't a lot of other flavor, you know, a little crispy, a little crunchy, but there wasn't much other flavor to them.
Well, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization is trying to make a case for why insects should be on more U.S. dinner plates. And why do you think there is such a reversion to not
to eating insects?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've never really thought of eating an insect until I read the report, and I thought, yeah, I don't know if I'd want to eat one or not. But
well, I think it comes from many different factors, but maybe some of the ones that come to mind as the most important is, first of all, at least here in the United States, a lot of people's, the average person's viewpoint of insects is, ooh, they're bad. They're ugly. They're icky. They live in icky places. They cause me harm. They might bite me. They might feed on my plants. They're disgusting animals. And so most people aren't very inclined to want to eat something that they consider a disgusting animal. I think another big part is that if it was a more mainstream in the United States, where you did see them in restaurants, or people ate them as part of their diet, and as a child you were exposed to them, you'd be more inclined to be positively inclined to want to eat them. Whereas again, in our kind of environment that we have, our cultural environment, it's kind of ooh, and those so. A child's going to say the same thing, and they're not going to develop a palate for that. The texture, the flavors, the visual, appearance are all things that I think people have to kind of adapt to if they're going to use something as a food item.
Well, and it's also having that, if you have a whole insect in front of you, when it's live, you're going to cook it. Would I do that with my chickens? Well, I haven't gotten to that point yet. I wouldn't do it with a cow, do the slaughtering. So why do you think that the UN is trying to get us to eat more insects?
Well, I mean, certainly where they are a larger part of the diet or a mainstay of many diets is tends to be in developing, or what we might call third world countries where their access to protein is not nearly what it is here, because of cost and just maybe physical access to. You live in very rural, remote areas. But places in Asia and Africa where beetle larvae, grasshoppers and other kinds of insects are common in that environment and have been taken advantage of as a very inexpensive, food source. That's the kind of cultural mentality, if you want to call it that, that kind of tends to drive that. And so I think that's where the UN is coming from, that, it is a very, it's readily available in many places. It's inexpensive. All you have to do is go out and collect them in some way and then prepare them. So it could be a very low-cost protein source to replace some of the higher-cost protein source. Very efficient in terms of, I don't know the statistics, but when you look at how much a cow eats, so how much it costs to get, a pound of beef versus a pound of insect larvae, I mean, it would be a major difference. The insect would be much, much cheaper.
So are there any that you know of that are trying to produce, mass produce insects for consumption?
Interestingly, I was contacted by an individual who had done a lot of different agricultural projects in China, and they were looking for sources of cicadas. Evidently, cicadas are popular, at least in some Chinese cultures, as a major food source or as a desirable food source, kind of as a specialty item. And so, we had this conversation on the phone, and we talked about, of course, when there's the emergence of the periodical cicadas, there's large numbers of cicadas on those areas, and they know where those different broods of cicadas are going to emerge. So that was what I suggested to them, as places in the Midwest and the eastern United States where there's these periodical cicadas. But he wanted to know where there were larger populations of annual cicadas. And so, we talked about that, but in general, we here in the United States, we haven't cultivated or tried to target those kinds of insects as a ongoing food source.
Well, wouldn't cicadas be a little difficult to try to produce if they have this? So, I mean, there's many. There's 11 years, there's 17 years, and I guess you could try to time them according to which ones are coming out.
And there's even what we would call annual, although they don't necessarily all emerge every year. There's some portion of the population that emerges every year, but an individual may stay in the ground for several years.
Why cicadas? Because they don't seem to me like there'd be a whole lot to them.
Well, it's kind of like grasshoppers and crickets. By the time and I don't know how the Chinese prepare them. I don't know if they fry them as typically crickets and grasshoppers, at least as they're consumed here in this country. I don't know, in Africa, and the migratory, what they call the locusts, which are big grasshoppers that migrate long distances, I'm not sure how they prepare them, if they do fry them or if they prepare them in other ways. But I would, you know, a cicada would contain a similar kind of texture, a lot of crunchy exoskeleton, not, you know, to the amount of interior goo, if you want to call it that. See, that's the problem. I can't get over that goo part.
So why wouldn't you want to eat a grub? Because, I mean, it does have more goo in it.
It does. I think it's a texture issue. You know, the amount of, I've dissected a lot of insects and their contents, their hemolymph, which is basically their blood that moves around in the open body cavity, their gut contents. You know, I've looked at a lot of that under the, you know, when I've been doing research with them. It's not, doesn't look very appetizing to me. It really is. It's kind of liquidy, gooey stuff.
Well, if you've had experience eating an insect, we would like to hear about it. Give us a call at 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Maybe you've crunched on a katydid or had chocolate-covered grasshoppers or whatever. 1-800-826-1495, or send us your email at zestygarden@gmail.com.
Oh, I forgot to mention another insect that I've eaten. Probably a lot of kids have done this. Maybe you even did this. Do you remember being told about if you eat ants, they taste like lemon?
No.
You never heard that? Well, they contain formic acid, which is what's in the venom that they use as a, you know, in their sting. And it does have a citrusy, you know, kind of flavor. So I remember eating ants, you know, not large amounts, but just trying them as a kid to see if I could taste that lemon flavor.
You were destined to be an entomologist very early on.
But there's not much to an ant. So I don't even remember. The texture thing wasn't a problem.
Well, so how do you know? That could be problematic if it's a fire ant. I mean, would you want to eat
a fire ant?
Oh,
yes. You have to be careful about which ants you pick. As I recall, you know, we were using magnifying lenses on the sidewalk killing ants, and so that's when the idea came up, and we popped a few of the roasted ones in our mouth. And, there was a little lemony flavor. It wasn't much.
Well, I think people would be interested to know that the average person already consumes 1 pound of insect parts per person per year.
Yep.
And you say, oh, no, I don't eat insects, but we do. It's in foods such as chocolate, peanut butter, fruit juice. So, I mean, it just gets into the process.
Yeah, to some of our different educational workshops, and we have sometimes carried around this jar of insects, body part, like legs and antennae and just different things that are represent a pound of insect parts, and showed this, people say, this is how many insect parts you eat per year. And of course, to the person, everyone says, no, I don't. It's like, yes, you do. You just don't realize it.
Well, and I suppose the more that you eat manufactured foods, maybe the more insect parts
is.
That you actually eat.
Yeah. I don't know if any of you caught there was a Dr. Michael Raup, who's a entomologist at University of Maryland, was on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno last month, back in June, when the cicada emergence was so big with the periodical cicadas. He actually ate cicadas on air and offered that. I think Russell Crowe was the other guest in there, and then Jay and Dr. Raup ate them. Russell Crowe declined. Even though in Australia, where he's from, he said that there they do eat them.
Well, let's move on to the next topic. I have been asked several different times about ants, so I thought I'd better get to that question right away. And I was at a friend's home last night, and she has this iris bed, and there are not the sugar ants, but the other more common, it's a larger ant. I have no idea what kind it is, but it had built a nest, and it was all along the edge of her garden bed. So like maybe 8 feet worth of this. I'm assuming it's the same colony of ants. And she said, I have them all over the place. They're in the front yard. They're in the backyard. She doesn't know how to get rid of them. And I've never stumbled across this much of an ant problem.
There's many, many different kinds of ants. So, I mean, we can make generalities, but then there's also, you know, differences, obviously, between them. But ants are generally oriented to eating kind of, you know, sweet things or more savory protein kinds of things. And so some of them are going to be eating other ants or other insects. Some are going to be eating seeds. or other kinds of plant parts. And so generally, they're going to be building their nests in places where they can have, where there's access to their food. So my guess is that she has maybe a lighter soil, a soil that's easy to build, to go down and excavate and build ant colonies, but also it's near some good food sources.
Do you know of any ants that like horse chestnuts, iris, Artemisia, or roses? That's what I saw in the close vicinity.
What I would guess is that this area where the iris bed is, it's because of the bulbs of the iris in the soil, it's kind of, the soil is fairly tilled up, so to speak. I mean, there's lots of room to move around.
And it is a raised bed on this.
And so they can easily go down and build their tunnels underground and make their colony. I know I've had ants build nests in rhubarb plants before, and they've actually ended up killing the rhubarb. They're not feeding directly on the rhubarb, but it's just the process of them making their tunnels and they're excavating all around the roots of the plant that they can actually end up killing the plant. So that's obviously not desirable. Plus just the concern of having, you know, a lot of stinging insects around. I would really suggest that they go with a bait product. There's a number of different baits that you can buy locally. And some of them have a sugary, you know, a type of bait, a carbohydrate source. Some of them have a protein type of food source in them. And I would just say, you know, try one. And if that doesn't work, then you could try another type to see what they're attracted to at that time.
Because they need to get that into the colony itself, right, down into the colony.
So they'll come and they'll, if they're attracted to it, they'll pick it up and they'll eat it, or they'll taste it, but then they'll take it down into the colony and feed it to the young. And then that, of course, helps lower the population of the colony much more quickly than just killing the foragers that you see out and about.
Any suggestions on the product, or just look for ones that are, yeah, more sugar oriented, or ones that are more protein oriented?
Right, that's what's on the market. You'll find some of both kinds. And so that would be my suggestion, is just use a bait product, put it out, sprinkle it on and around the colonies that this individual has in their yard, and see if that helps.
Also, I wanted to talk about coddling moth. Mm-hmm. I think the last Utah pest news that I received, at least here in Cache Valley, I need to begin spraying,
right,
again. There was a kind of a lull in between the first, right, and the second generation.
Right. So as you said, there's two generations primarily. We can sometimes have a part of a third generation in a warm year, which we'll likely have in our warmer parts of the state. And we always have a third generation down south in St. George area. But we're now getting ready. We have started and are getting ready to start the second generation, or the second flight of these moths. And so the egg laying for the second generation has already started in warmer areas along the Wasatch Front. So Salt Lake, Davis, Weber, Utah counties, that started last week. So we'll be getting into what we call peak egg hatch, where the numbers, a proportion of the eggs that hatch most rapidly in those places, coming up this weekend and early next week. So if you haven't got your spray out yet for that second generation, now's the time to do it.
And this is in Cache County?
No, here in Cache County. So I was getting to the little cooler places. So places like Cache County, Rich County, places that are a little behind the Wasatch Front. We're looking at around July 20th, 21st as the beginning of egg hatch, and getting into that peak egg hatch at the very end of the month. So July 31st, August 1st, right around there. So you want to be getting your spray on. It kind of depends. If you have a lot of pressure where, you know, you've had, you know, every apple infested with the worm in the past, if you don't do something, I would just go at that very first beginning of egg hatch. If you have lower pressure, you're more isolated, you've got, you know, you don't have apples around you that have a lot of infested fruit, you could, you know, wait a little bit and more target that peak egg hatch.
Why is it that coddling moth don't seem to be as attracted to pears as they are to apples? We don't get a few in my pears, but usually not very much.
You know, that's an interesting question, and it's true that early on, pears stay very hard and aren't that attractive until they start to soften up. And so I thought that way too and thought, well, I'm just not going to bother spraying my pears. I don't like to have to spray my fruit trees. If I don't need to, I won't do it. But I've been dinged on that with pears right at the end, right before they're getting, you know, ready to harvest. They get infested with larvae right at that time. And so I would say that with pears, you could often, I think in many cases, you could skip the first generation of management as long as you're, you know, doing that for the surrounding apple trees. But then at that second generation, I think it's a good time to manage in pear.
And there are many ways to manage this within either insecticides or more organically with, I love spinosad because I know I can, it's pretty safe for me and it doesn't bother other insects. It pretty well targets a chewing mouth part type
insect,
of insect, like the coddling moth caterpillar.
Right. So, you know, spinosad is still an insecticide, even though there is an organic formulation, but there's also inorganic or, you know, non-certified organic formulations too, which tend to be a little less expensive. The organic version tends to cost more. There's also another insecticide that's available for the homeowner that gives you about 2 weeks of control. So that's pretty nice. And that's called acetamiprid. And it's Orthomax has a product with that in it. But, you know, just look for what's kind of happened with home garden products is, you know, it's Orthomax, it's, you know, Fertilome, it's Greenlight. And that's the brand. But you have to look and read the small print to see what is actually the active ingredient in the product to know what you're getting.
Because you can't just buy, in the past, it's now no longer manufactured. It said diazinon was on the label.
And they don't tend to do that so much more. They just go with like Orthomax. And Orthomax can change. One year it might have acetamiprid in it, and next year it could have a different active ingredient in it. So you do have to look at what the active ingredient is. They're not making it any easier for the homeowner to identify which insecticide they're purchasing or which one they want to purchase.
What else is flying or crawling?
So another fruit insect that's going to be coming along here soon, so right at the end of the month, 1st of August, will be into the peach twig borer. So for those people who grow peach trees and have had the little brown, chocolate brown caterpillars that get into their peaches, generally they tend to get in right around the stem end. They're not as bad, if you want to call it that, as coddling moth, and that they don't kind of tunnel throughout the whole fruit, but they'll tunnel in at that stem end, tunnel around the seed. Sometimes you'll get decay in there, you get earwigs in there, certainly. So that insect is right at the end of the month when the timing for its second generation.
Of July?
Right.
Okay. So if I don't have any peaches, do I have to worry about it?
It can also get in apricots, but apricots are ripe now, so you don't need to be spraying them anymore.
And I don't have any of those,
so that's pretty much it.
I have some young trees, and I figure in Cache Valley, I'm going to be replanting peaches all the time. I usually get a couple of good years, and then something will get into it.
Occasionally, we can see coddling moth or peach twig borer getting into plum. It's not very common here, so I would say no.
What are the boring insects that kill the tree, that get into the peach?
So that's another, it's a little confusing because it's got peach also in the name, but it's called greater peach tree borer. And this is the one that bores right down at the base of the trunk and can girdle the tree and kill it. And those are out and active now. And so if you haven't done anything for that insect and you want to, for the homeowner, you're pretty much limited in what you can do. It's pretty much putting on a preventive lower trunk spray. The commercial growers have a great tool with mating disruption where they use pheromones to disrupt very effectively that insect, but you need at least an acre or so to do that. And so, you know, that's not suitable for homeowners.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden, and Diane Alston from USU Extension is my guest. If you have any questions or comments, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495, or you can email us your question at zestygarden.com. In the last little bit that we've got here, I did want to ask you, have you seen much in the way of parasitoid wasp populations going up? I mean, there was an interesting article in the Utah Pest News about that, and so I was just curious.
Well, we've been sampling the raspberry horntail, which is the wasp that actually attacks the canes of raspberry, and they cause the wilted tip. You see that tip wilt over, and if you were to slice into there, you can see the larva of the horntail. And we've been doing a variety susceptibility trial with that to look at which varieties of raspberry are more or less susceptible to the horntail. And we're seeing a lot of parasitoid wasps showing up attacking the raspberry horntail now.
Yes.
So that's a good thing.
That's a very good thing. And I have to say that I didn't see much in the way of horntail damage in my raspberries this year. So
that means you've done a good job in previous years of knocking down the population.
I hope so. It's sure taken a while.
Yeah.
Well, we've reached the end of our time. Thanks for coming
in.
Yes. You've been listening to The Zesty Garden, and Diane Alston, USU Extension entomologist, has been my guest. We're going to take a break, and then we'll come back with the next editions of Wait, Wait, Don't Plant That, as well as looking at some place to go hiking up Logan Canyon.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and with support from the Utah Shakespeare Festival, presenting the American classic 12 Angry Men, with seven other productions June through October 2013 in Cedar City. www.bard.org.
Welcome to Take a Hike. It's our way of being able to showcase some different hikes around the state, and we've been in northern Utah the last several weeks. And our next hike is also in the Tony Grove area, but not quite. And David Wallace, who is on the board of the Utah Native Plant Society and a leader with Cache Hikers, is in the studio with me. Hi, David.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and I love getting this information because I'm using it. I got to see the elk weed in blossom at the top of Logan Canyon last week, and I knew what it was. So that was kind of fun. So this week, we're going to talk about a couple of other flowers that are in blossom, but people need to get up into the mountains this month. So what do we got?
Well, I'd like to start by talking about another one of my favorite flowers. They're all my favorite flowers, if you want to know the truth. But this is one that I find quite interesting. This is Ptolemy's owl clover, or I guess I should say Noel's owl clover, because this is the subspecies we're talking about here in Cache Valley.
So it's not a true clover, though.
It's not a clover at all. It's a member of the snapdragon family. It doesn't look like a clover, but for some reason it's called that. In fact, I don't even know why they call it where the owl part comes in, except for the fact that it has a bulbous body with a beak on it. Maybe that triggered it with somebody. But I knew this plant, the yellow owl clover, from the Wasatch Front. I used to see it up in Albion Basin, for example, when I was looking for wildflowers, and it was a nice little plant with yellow flowers about 6 inches tall or so. But here in Logan, in our mountains near Logan, it is a different subspecies, and it is pink, rose-colored, and it grows a little taller, and it grows in drier soils. This was only been identified about 25 years ago, and it was named as its full name is Orthocarpus Ptolemyi variety, or subspecies Holmgreniorum, and which refers to the Holmgren family here that lived in Logan. And Arne Holmgren ran the herbarium, and his son Noel was a very well-known botanist as well.
Are they the ones that helped identify this subspecies?
I'm sure they had something to do with it, but somebody else had found it and named it for them.
Okay. And how tall is this?
It's about a foot tall. It's a fairly slender plant. It doesn't look, but it's maybe easy to overlook as you're walking along the trail. So I'd suggest to keep your eyes open, because it's a special one anyway.
So there's a similar yellow flowered, but this is the pink flower.
Yeah, the yellow flowered one grows in other areas. Here we'll find the pink one. This only is found from about Mount Ogden to just north of Montpelier in southern Idaho. So it's a fairly restricted plant.
So this is one you're not going to find just anywhere.
No, this is what we call an endemic. Okay. It's located in a specific area.
Okay. So a couple of other flowers on this hike. You have the sickle top lousewort, yellow coral root, thin leaf huckleberry, Whipple's penstemon. Sounds like there's a lot to see on this hike.
Yes, every hike is a wildflower hike. This hike, in order to get to the owl clover, you have to hike quite a ways through some varied terrain, and you end up on a dry ridge. where you find the owl clover. But as long as you're hiking there, you might as well pay attention to some of the flowers you're walking past. So I thought I'd showcase those as well.
Well, please do. So what's this next one?
Well, these are several of my favorites. And once again, these are my favorites because I don't see them very often. Here in northern Utah, our soils are derived from limestone, and they tend to be very basic. Well, these are plants that prefer to have some acidic soils and some cool and shade and moisture, and it just so happens that the slope there above Tony Grove is just perfect for that.
So what you're saying is don't try to grow, even if you get the seed, don't try to grow them in your own garden down here in the valley. It's probably not going to like it too much.
Well, I can't say for sure on all of them, but I see them in these soils, and I don't see them elsewhere, so I suspect that's the decision factor there. To start with, I'll start with the one we know is the most acid-loving, and that's the huckleberry. Huckleberry is a relative of the blueberries, and any gardener would know this, that we don't even grow blueberries in our state except by extraordinary operations that involve soil amendments and changing the pH and all sorts of other things. But it grows up by Tony Grove. It's found in much of our area, and I can tell you from my experiences in Glacier Park, it's all over the place up there. But here in northern Utah, just a few small places here and there.
So is this kind of the southern range, the southern part of where you would find this huckleberry?
No, it's not really the southern part. It's mostly because of the soil.
Okay.
Looking at my map, it goes all the way to Arizona and found all the way to the Midwest and up into Canada. But like I say, it's not commonly found here in northern Utah.
And is it going to be growing along the trail, or is it just going to be off the trail?
It grows, well, let me start talking about the trail so you can understand. The trail starts out shady and gentle and through a pine forest and on the cool north-facing slope, and that's where you'll find this one. Within the first half mile to mile, you'll encounter it. It's in patches along the trail.
So now this trail begins, it's a dirt road about a half a mile before we get to the Tony Grove parking lot up Logan Canyon.
Yeah, if you drive up Logan Canyon 20 miles and turn towards Tony Grove 7 miles, stop at 6.5, okay, and take the dirt road to your left across the old creek bed to the backcountry trailhead where the horsemen park their cars.
So you might see horses on the trail. Is this not a motorized?
You might
motorized vehicles at all?
No motorized vehicles, but you might see bicycles as well.
Okay.
It's nice and shady and cool, as I mentioned, and you'll see the huckleberry. Now, the huckleberry has already bloomed, but it's developing its fruit now, and you'll be able to identify that. And if you wait a few more weeks, you might be able to eat some of those fruits as they ripen.
And these are actually really quite good. I know a place above Preston in Emigration Canyon that I've picked huckleberries for, and it takes a long time to get even just like a cup and a half or 2 cups of berries, but they sure taste good in pancakes.
They are tasty, and here you'll have a lot of competition from all the other hikers and the wild animals as well. But okay. It's nice to know it's there.
Okay, so that's thin leaf huckleberry. What about this coral root?
The coral root is an orchid, a true orchid. And here we have the yellow color coral root. It grows in the same shady, piney areas as the huckleberry. It's about a foot tall, pale yellow in color. There's no chlorophyll, so it takes all of its food. It's a parasite, so it takes it from the plants around it. And it has these interesting little yellow flowers that that poke out from the stem.
And where would you see this along the trail?
It'd be right along, scattered through the shady areas and along that first, between about a half mile to a mile.
Okay. And sickle leaf lousewort?
So this is we talked last time about elephant head, which is one of the lousewarts, pedicularis. This is sickle-topped lousewort, pedicularis racemosa. And I saw this all the time in the Uinta Mountains when I would backpack in there. It's very common there. But once again, here, the only place I see it is in the slopes above Tony Grove. So it makes it a special plant to me in northern Utah. It has, it's about a foot tall, maybe 2 feet. And it has white flowers, small white flowers, with a curved beak on the top. I don't know for sure, but my guess is it has a pollination scheme similar to its relative, the elephant's head that we talked about last time.
And the last flower with this hike is Whipple's penstemon. And I've tried to grow these in my own yard and never had a lot of success, but I also don't have a mountain-type location in my yard, so maybe that's the problem.
Well, this is interesting. This is another one of my plants that I used to see when I hiked in the Uinta Mountains. Unlike our other penstemons, it grows in more higher elevations and moister, cooler, shadier areas. So like you, I thought that might be a good plant for my yard. And so I planted some in my yard, and it did not do well. It died after a year or so. And now the wheels have clicked in my mind, and I'm realizing it probably needs some acidic soil as well, because that's, once again, that's where I see it in the High Uintas and then here. What makes Whipple's penstemon different is its color. It is a deep, deep purple. The flower grows maybe a foot or two high, tall, but it has these big, wide-open penstemon-shaped flowers with the bilabiate, with the beard tongue. But they're so deep in color, they're just fascinating to me.
So it's a true dark purple. It's not got a little bit blue. I mean, there's Wasatch penstemon that, if that happens to be out and people see it, it's definitely got more blue color to it. This is actually purple.
Yes, this is actually purple, and it's I wouldn't say it's quite describes ours, but some people have said it looks wine colored.
Well, I love penstemons, and Utah has more penstemons than anywhere else in the world, so it's definitely worth a look to go out and see the Whipple penstemon. Anything else about this hike that you would suggest, or anything that we should know about? How long is the hike, elevation gain, that sort of thing?
Okay, well, the hike is starts out fairly easily. If you go to the backcountry trailhead, like I mentioned, the first half mile to mile is gently climbing. The Forest Service rerouted it a number of years ago. It used to be a straight run up and down the hill, subject to erosion, and they rerouted it so it's much better, which is good for us too, because it goes through those shady woods where these flowers grow, which is nice. If you don't want to start there, you can actually go to the campground and start at campsite number 13. There's a little trail that connects, going straight east in this case, to intersect the trail.
I see that here on the map, actually, and we'll have this map is on our website, so you can take a look at it. And you've got it marked where you can see the owl's clover as well as the huckleberry coral root, the lousewort, and the Whipple's penstemon.
I put a little note there that says camp trail. That's the trail of the campground if you want to take that route.
Okay.
And when you come down, by the way, make sure you take the right direction, or you'll end up at one of the other places where your car's not. If you end up at the campground, or
you'd eventually get there. It'd be the longer hike.
Yeah. The trail is nice and shady for the first mile or so. It goes over a ridge to, and if you're looking for our shady plants, you can quit right there, okay? If you want to go on to our owl's clover, you have to hike quite a bit more farther. Instead of a mile, you'll be going almost 4 miles.
And if you kept going on this trail, where does it eventually lead you?
Oh, this is a trail that has many connections. If you want to make a nice little loop out of it, you could go up to the Owl's Clover site on the Cottonwood Ridge. It's a dry, high ridge that borders the wilderness. That's where we find this plant. And then from there, you could circle back by way of the Blind Hollow and Hanson Pond, if you wish. Watch out for wrong turns. There's some false trails in there.
All right. David, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
You've been listening to our next edition of Take a Hike. David Wallace is a leader of Cache Hikers and on the board of the Utah Native Plant Society. And we'll continue to have more hiking reports in upcoming weeks, so stay tuned.
David wanted me to emphasize that if you continue on that trail, that you need to have either an expert with you that knows the area or have all the tools to be able to find your way back because of all the many connections and the ways you could get lost up in there. In our gardening calendar, I have one item. The Logan Iris Society is having their Iris Rhizome Sale. It's this Monday at 7 o'clock at the Logan Library. So please come and you'll be able to purchase irises and pictures will be available then as well. Coming up next now, we'd like to do a couple of different things and we'll move on with Zesty Garden.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. And for our Wait, Wait, Don't Plant That segment today, Mike Coons, USU Extension Forestry Specialist, is in studio. And what's our tree today, Mike?
We debated this, but Norway maple, I think.
Okay. Now, that's quite a lot to say, since there are many towns in this state that are lined with Norway maples.
Yeah. And there's a couple of aspects here. For one thing, it's a little bit of a weed, even in Utah. In the northeastern U.S., they can't believe we allow people to plant it because it's a declared legally noxious weed in some places in the northeast.
Well, in my backyard, if I don't get them out, they grow everywhere. I used the one as a 4 or 5 of them came up, and I used it as a screen, as a hedge almost until they started getting too big, and then I finally took them all out. But they just come up pretty easily.
And they are up some of our canyons. I don't think they're, given how long they've been here and how relatively little they've spread up into the canyons, I don't worry too much about them becoming a big problem. In Utah, the only trees really that are commonly declared noxious weeds are Russian olive and tamarisk, which is a shrub to a small tree. Norway maple is not a declared noxious weed here, so it is legal to grow it. So it's the weediness bothers me a little, and it's just that there are better maples, and it tends to not age well. You get a lot of limbs dying, and you don't know why. And I'm very familiar with this tree. I have 7 of them.
I'm taking it you did not plant these
no,
trees.
No, I didn't, but they're so important in terms of where they're placed.
So it didn't deter you when you were looking at this house?
No, it was beautiful, actually. Living with Norway maples, what do they say? Familiarity breeds contempt. Huh. I've had probably 5 of them suffer severely from girdling roots, which is really common in Norway maples, more so than many other species of trees, where the roots kind of go sideways when they come out from the trunk and cross over one another. And then when the trunk grows in diameter, the base of the trunk, and the roots start to grow in diameter, the big woody roots, and then there's crossing roots that start to grow in diameter, when they all reach each other, it's the perfect storm, and you end up with the tree starting to decline. And I've got 6 as street trees in my parking strip. There really isn't big enough. It's not a big enough area for them, but I've got them. And I've got one that this year will determine whether I just have to remove it or not, because I've twice done a root color excavation with a trowel and a shop vac and cut roots that were girdling other roots. And hopefully this year it'll start to come back. It'll take a few years.
That's the hard thing about those. If you do cut them down, it's going to take a long time to replace the shades. So I'm assuming that's why you haven't been keeping them that long.
Yeah. And if I do replace it, I think I'll come behind the curb on my side of the curb, because I only have about a 40-inch planting strip from curb to sidewalk.
That's a great spot for native perennials that don't need any extra
water.
Right,
yeah. So. And then get my trees behind the sidewalk. It'd still be a hard decision, though, because I'd still have 5 left, and some of them are, the biggest one is probably 20 inches in diameter.
And then the other problem is the insects. Every year, except maybe last year, in my place, I've had aphid problems. You can just see the leaves shining with the honeydew from the aphids. And I told my son, I says, "Yeah, that's aphid poo."
Yeah, yeah. And
he's like,
aphids
really?
Are really bad this year.
They're terrible
on Norway maple and lindens, especially, but even on some pines and it's really bad. And but aphids by themselves wouldn't be enough to make the decision for me to not plant it, but it's more the dieback that it's prone to, you know, especially any dieback that opens up part of the trunk or a large branch to direct sunlight that hasn't had direct sunlight in a while. It just seems like it doesn't do well, and you make a pruning wound on the west or the south side of a tree, and it gets direct sun. You know, what might be a 4-inch diameter pruning wound will die way back before it'll finally start making the callus and heal it over. So that's the main problem with Norway maples to me. And I know a lot of people have them, and I'd be interested to know how many of people who have them, what proportion like them when they've been with them for a while.
But they're not being used any longer or recommended anyway by cities to put in along the street. They're doing other ones now.
There probably are still a number of cities that are on acceptable plant lists. And really, in terms of Norway maple, we've got, it's an okay tree. We have enough. And so part of the reason I'd be saying don't plant any of them is don't plant any more. Mm. We have plenty. It'll take a while till the proportion of the tree population that is Norway maples gets down to a reasonable proportion. You'd like to not have more than 10% of the trees in a town or city be any one species in case something happens like the Dutch elm disease did with the American elm.
Well, you look at Logan's Main Street, and there were maples up and down Main Street. And now, at least on the south end of town, they were just starting to die back and not looking very good, and the city has taken them all out and replaced them with London Plane.
Right, and it's that's the dieback I'm talking about.
Okay.
And actually, the old quad here on campus has mostly is tree-lined with Norway maples, and over the next several years, we're phasing that to, in this case, it's going to be London Plains, and then London Plain will be pretty much reserved for that place on campus.
And London Plains are also known as?
Well, sycamore by a lot of people, yeah. And so we have enough. they're okay trees, but we have enough, and we don't need more.
So for today's Wait, Don't Plant That segment, the recommendation is don't plant Norway maples. Now, can you plant Rocky Mountain maples in their place?
Yeah, actually.
Since that is a native.
I think the one you're probably talking about is Canyon maple or Big Tooth
Big
maple.
Big Tooth, yeah.
Rocky Mountain maple is actually another species of maple native to Utah that doesn't get very big. It's kind of small and shrubby. And it would be fine, but
so the big tooth maple would be okay.
Yeah, it has good fall color. Really
better than Norway. Norway.
Uh huh. Yeah, and the only thing with a big tooth maple is currently there's only one named cultivar that's been grafted and is genetically selected, and unfortunately the wholesaler grafts them onto Acer rubrum, which is red maple rootstocks from the eastern U.S., and they do okay here, but they don't get all that good a fall color. And but it is a more tree form, upright tree form.
So does the rootstock affect the color of the leaves that much?
I think so.
Wow.
In that case, it does, I think. And they know that it might do better on some other rootstock, but they're just red maple works well for them to grow for rootstocks, so that's what they do. But they are looking at some other big tooth maple cultivars, that particular wholesaler is, and actually USU's been involved with getting them some new selections.
So we'll be looking forward to having those.
Yes.
Mike, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Wait, Don't Plant That segment with Mike Coons, USU's Extension Forestry Specialist. And you can go online and get some great information with the Tree Browser. And that's produced through Utah State University. And what's the address, Mike?
Just treebrowser, all one word, .org.
This is Utah Public Radio. KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.